When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Slate's Double X Gab Fest is sponsored by Smith & Noble, featuring custom window treatments handcrafted to your personal style, design, and color preferences. Get 20% off your window treatments plus a free in-home consultation when you go to smithandnoble.com/xx. And by Blue Apron, the new service that delivers all the farm-fresh ingredients you need to make incredible meals at home. Discover a better way to cook. Visit blueapron.com/XX to get your first 2 meals free. That's blueapron.com/DOUBLEX. And by NatureBox, shipping tasty and guilt-free snacks right to your door. With over 100 flavors to choose from, you'll never get bored of snacking again. Try NatureBox for free by going to naturebox.com/XX. That's naturebox.com/DOUBLEX.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the Double X Gab Fest for Thursday, June 11th, the Triple X edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a writer for Slate and The Atlantic. I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
Okay, so let's jump right in. Our three topics for today. First, Emma Sulkowicz, the Columbia student who carried a mattress around to protest the university's handling of sexual assault, made a sex tape or a piece of performance art. We are definitely going to regret talking about this topic, but we are going to do it anyway. Oh, boy. Second, Caitlyn Jenner versus feminism round one is transgender acceptance, pushing us to reaffirm sexist stereotypes. And third, Aziz Ansari's new book, Modern Romance, takes on dating in the age of the text. Okay, here we go with Emma Sulkowicz. You guys ready?
Mm-hmm.
Have you peeled your eyes off of the video to pay attention to what I'm about to say?
Yes, ma'am.
Surely. Okay, good. So Emma Sulkowicz, she's now a Columbia grad, and she keeps finding devious and brilliant ways to bring attention to her cause, which is how universities mishandle sexual assault cases. Earlier this month, she carried her mattress on stage at graduation, and Columbia's president declined to shake her hand. Now she's made – it's not really a sex tape, right? Even though all the headlines called it a sex tape, I have to stop doing that. That sounds wrong to me. It's not a sex tape, right?
I mean, it seemed like right-wing sites called it a sex tape, and – sites that were more sympathetic called it a piece of performance art.
But like Slate email went around saying Emma Sulkowicz made a sex tape. Like there's something just short and quick about that that gets you, nobody right. The headline is never going to say Emma Sulkowicz makes a piece of performance art.
Well, right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think if Slate, I don't think Slate wrote about it, but if it had, I don't know that it would have caught me. I don't know. But
anyway, okay, we haven't even said what it is because I'm presuming that not every single one of our listeners has seen it. So who is going to volunteer to describe this video for me? Because we can't really do this with sound.
Right.
I mean, there's not very much sound.
I can describe.
All right.
First, I will set the scene with how I watched this, which is I watched it at work. And because it is either a sex tape or a performance art project, but whatever it is.
Or perhaps even amateur porn.
It's naked people having sex. So I took my phone into a conference room and like... and watched it at work, which is probably the perviest I've ever felt at work.
And it's long. Let's just say it's 8 minutes long. So you got to lock yourself in that closet for a long time.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, it's four cameras in a dorm room.
Surveillance style.
Surveillance style, different perspectives. And Emma and a man whose face is blurred out, but seems like maybe possibly sort of an older guy with, you know, a hairy chest and all that.
I didn't know if this was
start making out, and they are, you know, sort of progressing, and they start having sex, and she's on top, and then they switch, and he's on top, and it gets rougher, and he begins to hit her and choke her and takes off the condom and keeps going, and she's telling him to stop, and he keeps going, and he finishes and leaves, and she sort of picks herself up and, you know, takes a shower and changes her sheets and then just lies there on the bed, and you watch that on the mattress. And that is the project.
Yeah, and the mood of it goes from kind of sort of lackadaisical, kind of sullen porn to suddenly incredibly uncomfortable and violent. I mean, he slaps her out of the blue. You don't see it coming. Mm-hmm. And then right. he kind of surges with this anger, mm-hmm. you know, like mm-hmm. he rips his condom off. And they're not close up like porn, but you can see he's moved into anal sex and she's saying ow and no, because mm-hmm. the rest of it has been fairly silent, right? So then it's ow and no. And then he kind of walks out the door abruptly without even putting his clothes on. And then it goes into this really depressing, morose silence as mm-hmm. she's trying to remake the bed and just lies there in a fetal position. So it's very moody, you know?
You know, and we should say it's called Ceci n'est pas une viol, which is, of course, a reference to René Magritte's Ceci n'est pas une pipe, which is also known as The Treachery of Images. And I think when you go to the site to watch it, there's this pretty extensive bit of text at the top, which is confusing, a little bit theoretical, talks about, you know, the sort of the mood that you come to it with, that if you, I mean, actually I should read it because there's one line that's very, please don't participate in my rape, watch kindly, she says. She also says, you might wonder why I'm making myself this vulnerable. Look, I want to change the world, and that begins with you seeing yourself. I mean, this is, by her lights, a piece of performance art. I think if it was a more clear piece of advocacy, that's not the kind of language that you would use. It's very much an individual project rather than something that, like, this is not what you would make if you were, you know, an anti-rape group that was trying to make a video to, you know, change minds. However, I do think it's pretty effective in a way of making people think about how a consensual sexual act can very quickly change without anything being said and without really any way of changing things.
She also, I mean, the interesting thing, as you have just illustrated, it's very hard to settle. And she does this on purpose on how to view this thing mm-hmm. or what you think of it. Because even her warning, please watch this kindly, is confrontational and devious in a way. Because she's saying, if you watch this and consider this or think about it as a rape, then you have re-raped me. Because in fact, this is not rape. This is a consensual video, which I have made with a hired actor. So you couldn't, it's not like someone could watch this and very earnestly decide, as many of the commenters have, you go girl, right? Mm-hmm. And we should mention that she purposely left the comments on. Mm-hmm. She wanted to leave the comments on, and because she wanted to, this should be about basically not just what happened to her, but what happened to her after what happened to her. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of how we all dissected her case, how we all superimposed narratives on her case. So she wants that to play out in the comments, which it very much does. You know, they range from like, you're so brave, to you little slut,
right.
You know?
And I mean, it's a very complicated thing to watch because it's not crazy to be turned on by it. It's not crazy to think, wow, look at that guy's penis. Like, I really wanted his, okay, is that a big penis? I mean, like, I was kind of having these questions about the kind of sex they were having or why she's walking around naked. Like, why are you exposing yourself like that? Even though, again, if I think of it as a piece of performance art, I think, well, you know, art very often exposes people. And, you know, that's kind of how we're always having these complicated feelings of, whoa, I'm looking at a naked person. But usually it's a model or a subject, and this is her. And since we've been privy to such sort of intimate details of her, some sex that she had in August 2012, there are all these levels of kind of, you know, complicitness and complication. And it's very, it is a piece of film that brought up many sort of responses in me of many different kinds.
The thing that I couldn't settle on is that this video, with the four camera angles, with the annotation that she does at the beginning, is a condoning of subjectivity, right? She's saying this is subjective. Like, it's your choice how to watch this. It's like, as much of performance art is, it forces you to be complicit and subjective, which is essentially the opposite of activism. Right? Like, in her activism, or in one's activism, you're not really asking for subjectivity. You're saying, this is a rape. I want you to consider this as a rape. That's where I couldn't settle on what I was supposed to believe. Because, in fact, the act of watching it did kind of help me understand her legal case better. Mm-hmm, you know, it did help me understand how watching something helped me much better than reading something see, you know, how an encounter that started consensual could become, like, really violent and not consensual in the middle and just kind of happen, you know, like a frog in boiling water, sort of slowly, and then suddenly you're in a completely different space. And yet her text kind of challenged that certainty that I had at the end of watching that video.
Right. The way, if you go to the page now and look at it, the date is blurred out, but originally the date that was showing on the surveillance cameras was the date of her rape.
Oh,
or her alleged rape.
I didn't realize that.
And so even though she says this is not about the events in that August night, you think, well, is it now? And then, so then, I don't know, then you're thinking, okay, are you going to text this guy later? And it is her. You know it's her. We all know what she looks like. Oh, no, and look, there's a mattress. And it's very effective at bringing up questions. But I don't know. I don't know that it really I don't know what it is saying about sexual assault on campus.
Right. Well, I think it's saying about sexual assault on campus that
actually, boy, are you speaking slowly? Because I could see all the gears turning in there.
Well, there are no cameras in dorm rooms, right? It's he said, she said, and there's no evidence. It's it's, you know, two parties experiencing something differently from one another. And that, I think, is the message that I got from the project. I can't decide if I think it's too heavy-handed or not. That's what I've been going over. I mean, I can just see, like, how am I going to shock the world? I'm going to, like, fuck on camera.
Yeah.
But then, as you guys were talking it through, it seems like there are more layers than I'd even been thinking through. I guess one thing that I still can't square is how it actually fits with the previous project. I know it seems very like a very obvious progression, but the previous project seemed explicitly political and more action-oriented almost. Like, she had a specific thing on campus that she wanted to change, and that didn't happen, right? And she had a very specific alleged crime that she wanted, you know, to be tied up. And now it's this bigger thing that's like, you know, it's not just my rape, it's, you know, what's happening in all these dorm rooms, and it's kind of an anonymous dorm room.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked myself into a corner on this.
I to me, it tipped me pretty solidly into the camp of Emma Sulkowitz as a gifted performance artist and too complicated as an activist. Like, her point is blurred in this video. I mean, there are points of realism, like you say, the timing of the video, the fact that it is meant to look like security footage, so that has some, that triggers in our minds, you know, this is real, this is happening. On the other hand, the encounter is not very real. Like, there's no sort of sexual energy between them. You know, it's very sort of going through the motions. Like, it doesn't actually, to me anyway, look like a real and genuine sexual encounter. Right. Emotionless in the beginning of it. Am I wrong about that?
No, not at all. It's like they, you know, it's like a script. Like, okay, first we do oral sex, like, for 10 seconds, and then we move on to the next thing.
And not even like a porn script where the woman is faking it or making noises or moaning or anything like that. It's like, you know, robots having sex in the beginning. and then she turns into a human, right, who manifests pain, and then she continues to be human. But that's, it also was very complicated to me to watch how the sexuality kind of brought out nothing in her. No sound, no noise, not much pleasure. I mean, really nothing. But the pain, when it kind of turned violent, that brought out a lot in her. I mean, it was all negative, but it's like mm-hmm. it's only in the pain that she became to me a human being,
that's
which was really freaky for me.
Performance art is all about the gray areas, right? And she and activism is not about the gray areas. And
or you could say performance art is about context. And activism and legal cases are also about context. So it depends a little bit on how she shades that.
I don't know. To me, the difference is between her. This is a very individual project. This is about one woman's view, one woman's situation. It's all about her, which is fine. There's nothing negative in saying that. And I just feel like an advocacy project is always, even when you use, you know, it's the classic thing to use one woman's story, but you then always open it up to, you know, there's got to be that kind of final section where, you know, you connect the person that we've just met and who we've gotten to know and say, you know, how her experience is like other people's, what you can do. There's, you know, there's no call to action. There's no, oh, you know, we've got to change the way that colleges deal with sexual assault. We've got to deal with, you know, encouraging women to report sexual assault. There's no action item. You're like, it's...
But isn't that what she does in the thing that you read? In other words, this is you, June, your choice to watch this video, your choice to participate in this circumstance. Are you going to participate in this circumstance as a voyeur? Are you going to, you know, judge my body and like my sex technique, as people do in the comments? Or are you going to participate in this by reading my story and being sympathetic, being kind, you know, choosing to do something about it? So she doesn't direct your choice in a sense. She doesn't sort of say you have to land in this box, but she does say you have to make, by doing this, you are doing something active. Like she pulls you out of passivity and pulls herself out of passivity and says, make a choice.
See, that what you have just said is quite convincing. However, I don't know that her text, which is rather theoretical, rather confusing, which is great if you want to spend a lot of time pondering it, but I don't think that it's actually all that effective. I think it's too theoretical, too Brechtian, and not call to action-y enough.
It's not quite a call to action, but what the response she wants is exactly the one that Hannah has had, which is, I think Hannah got from watching the tape rather than reading the text, which is that, you know, like consent is
always shifting.
Mm-hmm. And that someone who's not on campuses and just reads about it, like, you know, to have this visceral experience is what she wants people to have, right?
And I do think that's effective. And I guess, too, as somebody who's old enough to be, well, certainly her mother, maybe even her grandmother, like, I just feel like I worry for her. Like, she is making herself so vulnerable. I don't like that people are talking about her oral sex technique. I don't, that feels like, will she in 15, 20 years regret having made what some people will call a sex tape or amateur porn or whatever? Like,
I thought that was the most brilliant part of it is like she captured something so essential about this moment where women can be completely vulnerable and exposed and yet oddly in control of the situation. And both of those things are simultaneously true, and it's really hard to figure out. Like, she's even confessing. Like, it's this weird thing where, like, you know, he rapes her or he assaults her. She curls up into a baby and then she's, like, kind of reborn, you know, which is what happened to her. Like, she becomes a person and a famous person and she takes on an identity, and that's really weird. But it's almost as if she captures every element of this very contradictory moment that I can never make sense of. You know, I think I've written, like, I'm so confused by this. Like, how is it that it's this sex positive, you know, end of men moment and simultaneously just extreme vulnerability on campus all at once? And this piece of performance art, like, captured that vibe or double vibe better for me than anything else I've seen or read.
It also made me think, in a weird way, that she's more serious than I was giving her credit for before about her art. Like, she's all in. Like, and I think, you know, my own response, I had the same response you did initially. I was like, shit, like, a friend, her mother, someone should have talked to her. By the way, her mother completely endorses the project. She posted about it on Facebook. And so I think Emma Solkowitz, for her, this is not a choice she will regret. I think other people might, but it doesn't seem like she's the kind of person who would.
God, her mom.
Her mom posted
about it. Can't the moms give the kids anything to rebel against? It's like they're going to endorse this?
I know.
Jesus, moms.
I know.
Put your foot down somewhere.
I just want to take something back that I said. I am not old enough to be her grandmother.
You're definitely not. Like back. Maybe some teen moms in there, but yeah.
All right. Enough. Let's move on. But before we do that, we'd like to thank our first sponsor, Smith & Noble, the window treatment company. Okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do a report card for our sponsors, and it's going to be a do you make a lady's life easier or harder report card. Now, don't worry, sponsors. You're all going to win. You make the lady's life easier. So here's how Smith & Noble does that. So, you know, I think some women, dare I say many women, are enough into decorating and wanting their place to look nice. Okay, that may be a stereotype, but let's say some women are. I am, but only to a certain extent, which is to say I get bored really, really quickly. And so here's how Smith & Noble solves my problem. They have a great website. They have a great catalog. They have all different kinds of window treatments, from honeycomb shades for kids, drapery for bedroom. An expert comes to your home, works with you one-on-one, measures, orders, and installs. It's all very fast and very easy. So Smith & Noble gets an A. They also have an incredible offer for our listeners. Save 20% off your window treatments. Gate-free in-home advice. For a special offer, go to smithandnoble.com/XX. smithandnoble.com/XX.
How do you spell Noble?
What do you mean?
I mean, is it N-O-B-E-L or N-O-B-L-E?
Oh, like could it be the person's name or the human quality? All yes. Right, I'll spell it out. Smith and... You guys can spell that, right?
Yes.
N-O-B-L-E.com. But thank you. I never thought of that. Yes.
Smith is it and spelled out?
Stop it. I'll do this the right infomercial way so that one day I will be hired to do a true infomercial.
You're hired.
S-M-I-T-H-A-N-D-N-O-B-L-E. If that's too fast, you can slow it down on your device. Okay. Okay, on to our second topic, Caitlyn Jenner. In a Sunday Review piece this weekend, Eleanor Burkett makes the case that Caitlyn Jenner's coming out with her virginal white dress, her ample cleavage, her pouty lips, reduces womanhood to some hoary old stereotypes. She writes, "That's the kind of nonsense that was used to repress women for centuries. But the desire to support people like Miss Jenner and their journey towards their truest selves has strangely and unwittingly brought it back." Okay, June, since I'm sure you must be better steeped than the rest of us in the history of, I have a problem with this phrase, but let's start by saying radical feminists versus transgender activists.
Yeah.
Can you talk about, like, now that it's made its way into the mainstream, thanks to Caitlyn Jenner, what was it in your life before this? Sort of give us a little background on this conflict.
Well, I certainly not to say that I have not made mistakes as an ally of trans people, but I feel that the setting up of this sort of opposing camps between TERFs, which is to say trans-exclusionary radical feminists, and transgender people, is to me one of those sort of false fights. It's horizontal hostility that just, you know, is just exactly what the patriarchy wants. That is not to deny that it exists. Certainly in the 70s, 80s, there was scholarship, people like Janice Raymond writing against transgender existence, really. So I'm not to deny anyone's reality. There is a real, you know, tension there, and Eleanor Burkett represented it to a certain extent. But I just feel like we do not need to be having this fight. I would say that I have less in common with Caitlyn Jenner than I had with Bruce Jenner, but that's okay. I still recognize her as my sister. It just feels like this completely unnecessary hostility and fighting. You know, we don't have to all be the same. We're not all the same. You and I are pretty different, Hannah, but we're, you know, we can get along and fight together pretty well. I don't know. I just don't understand this.
How are we different?
This clash. I mean, we have different interests. We have different lives. You know?
Yeah. I think, you know, it's funny because this came to the fore. Michelle Goldberg wrote a piece in The New Yorker, which might have actually had the exact same headline, What Makes a Woman, I think, than that the New York Times piece have. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, so it has been presented as a conflict between radical feminist and transgender, like it's an internal feminist fight.
Right.
But I actually think it is more than that, and it does kind of matter. And I'm not sure about this, but maybe you guys can help me. Here's how I think it matters. We looked at Caitlyn Jenner in the Vanity Fair photo shoot. Mm-hmm. We all applauded her coming out, as we should. But it was really, the experience was like looking at a princess. Like, would we stand up and applaud a princess or even Kim Kardashian? It's like we suspended our irony at what she looked like and the form of femininity that she embodied and just clapped. And that was funny to me. It's like, it's 2015. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't, when you turn into a woman, have to be this kind of cartoonish woman, right? Is it because we're too new in transgender activism that she can't come out and be any form of woman? You know, in a way, it was almost distancing between me and Caitlyn Jenner for her to come out as this kind of woman, like, of the Marilyn Monroe 40s that I barely recognize as a sister anymore.
But that's, you know, her. That's exactly the woman that she wants to be. Like, yeah. How else was she supposed to do it?
I don't know. Would you ever look at, you know, a picture of Kim Kardashian looking like that and just completely applaud it? Like, no irony, just say, oh, that's wonderful.
But it's not Kim Kardashian. Right. It's a totally different context. I mean, were we really supposed to come out and say, you're too much of a girly girl, you person, yeah, who until very recently we understood to be a man? I think the overwhelmingly positive response, it came from a good place for people, and I just don't want to overanalyze that.
Exactly. Too much.
They're, like, for people like me who maybe don't have the vocabulary to speak about this in a totally sophisticated way, I think it's okay to just say she looked great. And that's what I think a lot of America said, and people criticized it, that we were already, Jon Stewart had a bit that went viral, that we were already treating her like a woman, which is that, you know, people were only judging her based on her appearance. Right. But the salient fact of the photo shoot was that Caitlyn Jenner's appearance had radically changed from the last time we saw her as Bruce Jenner. And that was just what people were reacting to.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I meant when I said I have less in common with Caitlyn Jenner than I had with Bruce Jenner. Like, that is, it's almost like she's the opposite of me now. The way she looks, the way she is, you know, into her girly stuff, that is absolutely nothing like me. But that is not every woman. That's her. And I just don't, you know, that's how you get on the cover of Vanity Fair. It's, is there an issue with us judging people on their appearance? Yes. Is there an issue with only appearing to be positive about trans women who look like Janet Mock or Laverne Cox or Caitlyn Jenner, who is 65 years old? And, you know, when 65-year-old people look good, we always are, you know, kind of nice to them. That is, you know, this is all like a critique of the patriarchy that we can make and should make. But I just don't see that there's like, do I wish she were not a Republican? Yes. Do I wish that she were a little bit less hung up on girly stuff? Probably. But it doesn't hurt me any. It's not, I don't feel that some women being girly, including some trans women, is a problem for feminism. I mean,
see, the Republican part is the thing I like the best, because she is just so messing with their heads.
Yeah.
Like, there was a great Washington Post story about Caitlyn Jenner and the Republican Party, in which it was just so pleasurable to watch the likes of William Bennett contemplate the likes of Caitlyn Jenner and just, you know, full force see how they lost the culture war. I mean, that's the one thing I liked about the universal applause, is
Absolutely.
Just watching them think, really? Like, the nation has reached a point, like, okay, we made it as far as gay marriage because it had the word marriage in it. Mm-hmm. But this, like, we also have to accept this on the cover of a magazine.
It's kind of the libertarians have won, right?
Yeah.
Like, Bruce Jenner, I don't know his precise politics, but it's like, you know, do whatever the hell I want in my personal life. Get, you know, I own guns and I'm also a transgender woman. Like,
right.
Back off.
Right.
I want lower taxes. It's just, I
right.
Think
so
it's
the
that.
Libertarians win over the social values.
Yeah,
Republicans.
Totally.
That's
which they've
enough.
Been doing for, I think, a long time. Not a long time, but in recent history. Can we just talk about that op-ed, though, a little bit more?
Which one?
The New York Times one.
Eleanor Birkin.
Eleanor, yes. It really, it was atop the New York Times most emailed for a while, which I found interesting because her position, theoretically, is this very extreme one, this radical feminist position. But there are all these sort of like people sipping lattes and hitting send mm-hmm. to their friends on it. So there must have been something that people were responding to in it. Was it her argument that, you know, it's wrong that when Caitlyn Jenner said her brain is more of a woman's brain, that's wrong, that you know, there's not such a thing as a woman's brain? Was it the argument that like a trans person cannot have had the same experiences as someone who is born a woman? Is it her? Is it simply just the fact that she, you know, brought up the fact that the vagina monologues are banned at I forget which college?
Yeah.
But what was it in that article that people were responding to so strongly?
What do you think, Hannah?
You know, I think it might be what you were saying, which is that somehow someone can make a public presentation as a woman, in other words, a surface presentation as a woman, and thus they are a woman. And so she feels like that, you know, the history of feminism and the point we're at now is such that, you know, how we appear has really not little to do with who we are inside. She wasn't making the complicated radical feminist distinction between gender and womanness, right? Mm-hmm. So they don't believe in gender. Everything's right. Entirely a social construct. It's not in your brain. It's entirely determined by the patriarchy in society. That's the kind of philosophical struggle between radical feminists. I have to say, this wasn't the most coherent right. piece right. I've ever read. Like, she neither surfaced a lot of the arguments made by the second waivers who are part of this kind of fight with the trans people, nor did she like completely articulate the mainstream objections. So you really had to work hard to understand what it is in her argument that people were responding to. But I think it's just this like, there are all kinds of women, and so why does this get stamped with a label? Okay, now we recognize you as a woman just because you're wearing a pretty dress, instead of recognizing you as something else, which is transgender.
Well, I don't think we really want to have a whole third. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's tricky because a lot of the stuff about, you know, if you've never suddenly gotten your period on a crowded subway, you're not a woman. I don't know. I mean, there's lots of things that Elena Burka is a white woman. There are things that I'm sure have been experienced by black women that haven't been experienced by Elena Burka. Does that mean she's not a woman? No, it means she's not black. I mean, there are so many different kinds of women. There's so many different kinds of experience. I'm cautious about saying if you haven't had experience X or experience Y, then you don't get to wear this label. I mean, I do recognize absolutely that these shifts in gender are really very destabilizing. So many things that we take for granted are being challenged by people being able to shift gender or what we perceive as their gender. I mean, there are so many things in life that we embrace, I think, because they're a kind of a toggle switch. You're either married or you're not married. You're either heterosexual or you're not heterosexual. You're either this or you're that. And I think so many of these things, you're either black or you're white, you're either, you know, cisgender or transgender, you're either male or female. There are just so many things that we have traditionally just accepted as you're one thing or the other, that more and more we're saying, actually, no.
So, but that's my problem with it. So, but isn't that what Caitlyn Jenner's coming out completely reverses that whole like wonderful diversity you just described? Because she is now a woman. She's like, her brain is a woman's brain, her body, her psychic identification. If you call her that, then you are accepting that there is some bright outline around the term woman.
Why?
You know, because she's not a transgender woman. She's a woman. So there is thus something essentially called the woman, which is defined by her brain, which is defined by her outfits. It's like you erase all the complexity and you suddenly have a clear, here is man, here
I guess,
is woman.
I guess I don't see that at all, because to me it's just broadening the definition of woman.
Yeah, that was my response too. And it reminded me of the way social conservatives talked about gay marriage, or still talk about gay marriage, as if it were taking something away from their own right. heterosexual marriage, when no, it's not. Like, right. it's a different thing. And maybe you could even extend the analogy a little farther and say that, like, it seems as if some people in gay marriages like define monogamy differently than people in straight marriages. But we're still calling it a marriage.
Right.
It's just like, it's I mean, it still is a marriage. It's right. just like, and we're calling Caitlyn Jenner a woman, and she is a woman because that's how she understands herself to be. It's just shorthand. Like, we can't, yeah. we can't just like go into an extremely long explanation. You know, I'm a heterosexual white woman, but you know, I had a tomboy phase. Like, you can't you can't go into everyone's complicated right. gender identity every time you talk about them. It's just easy to say she wants to be a woman, she's a woman.
Yeah, and maybe you know, to ease my concerns, maybe in 20, 30 years you will be able to, you know, come out as a woman in lots of different ways, as I'm sure people do, and that's fine. All right, well, let's hope that Caitlyn Jenner takes advantage of this moment and makes the reality show something interesting that teaches Americans even more. Okay, let's move on to our third topic, comedian Aziz Ansari's new book. But before we do that, we are going to thank our second sponsor, Blue Apron. Again, I am giving them the lady report card. Should I call it the feminist report card, or is that too much? You think just like the woman report card?
You already really went sure. with lady on the other one. I okay, think you're
lady,
in for a pound.
Lady report card. I'm in for a pound. Okay. So Blue Apron is a service that delivers the ingredients you need to make incredible meals at home. The ingredients are proportioned, come with an easy-to-follow recipe card. I think you know my answer. It makes your life much easier rather than having to do the things that you have to do, which are multiple, such as plan the recipe, shop for the recipe, make sure, and then run out and get the things that you forgot, which is, in my case, what always happens with the recipe. This makes it all happen in one easy box. They give you the recipe. They give you all the little treats that come. They make sure that it doesn't take much more than half an hour. You will cook meals like what is on their website right now, which is really delicious looking. My favorite is something called a frise and farro salad with goat cheese, which mm-hmm. looks incredibly delicious, and a cod, and I never managed to cook fish well, with pickled grapes and summer succotash. So mm-hmm. it's fairly fancy, but it happens fairly quickly. Okay, visit blueapron.com/XX to get your first two meals free. That's blueapron.com/XX. Do I need to spell anything out?
I was going
to
say, is it blue with an E?
No.
It's blueapron.com/XX. Okay, next. Aziz Ansari, who you all might know from Parks and Rec and his live comedy shows, which he does all over the country, has a new book out called Modern Romance. This book is an unusual combination of humor, advice, and real sociology. It is co-written, is that right, with Eric Kleinenberg? It's not really co-written because his name's not on the cover, but it's sort
of. But you can tell when he writes.
Yeah, well, okay, we'll talk about that. But anyway, it basically explains why every text you have ever sent to ask someone on a date, follow up after a date, or break up is completely stupid. So it is. It's painful to read, you know. You might recognize yourself in some of those texts. I definitely did. Even though I'm old for the dating, I still recognize myself. Okay, so it starts by analyzing his encounter with a girl named Tanya. He hooked up one night with her in L.A., and then he sent her this text. I guess I'll read the nice text he sent her. It says, "Hey, don't know if you left for New York City, but Beach House playing tonight. Beach House is a band that they've been listening to on their great hookup. You want to go? Maybe they'll let you cover The Motto if we ask nicely." Apparently, there was like a cute moment in the hookup when she was singing The Motto and happened to know all the words. Noreen, what happened?
She read it, which he could tell because it, you know, you got a little iPhone red receipt, which everybody, by the way, turn that off. There's a setting on your iPhone where you can turn that off.
Can I admit, like, I didn't even know that.
Oh, that you could turn it off?
No, I didn't know that there was a way to figure out if people can read your text.
Oh.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
It's okay. I did a devious thing once where I turned my mother's red receipts on so I could tell if she'd gotten my text, because my mom is not attached to her phone the way I am. Anyway, so Tanya read his thing, and then you can see on your iPhone when someone is
that
typing. They're the three little dots.
And I'm on. Yeah.
And so he could see that she was typing because he was sitting there waiting for her to text back, as you do when you text someone you are into. And then the dots stopped, and there was nothing, and there was total silence. And So he began, you know, as the hours ticked by, he began running through the possibilities, like, you know, maybe her phone is broken.
I love that. Her phone is broken.
She's gone out of town. Like, you know, had she died? Like, you know, what had happened? Why wasn't Tanya texting him back? And then he sees that she's logged into Facebook chat, which means she's probably not dead. And then he sees that she's Instagrammed a photo of a deer. And he's like, why the hell are you Instagramming a photo of the deer when you haven't texted me back? So he's basically driving himself crazy based on the fact that this woman has not texted him back. Which, by the way, is like an interesting gender reversal to think about. Yes. Usually it's the woman sitting at home in the popular literature, the woman sitting at home waiting for the guy to call. But now it's the dude who's put himself out there via a pretty anodyne, nice text message, and the woman who's callously ignoring him.
Well, I did find like the gender neutrality, which Amanda has pointed out in her review of the book, I like that a lot. Like, you really, it wasn't like advice for the men on how to, you know, how to like trick the ladies, or advice for the ladies on how to play the game. It was just like advice for the humans about your stupid ass text, you know?
Yeah, and he was very clear too. Like, it was, he was always very clear, like, okay, this is mostly for heterosexuals, but occasionally, like, he offered some, you know, examples from same-sex relationships. And I thought that was really very cool that he was aware of when he was only talking about some people. And I don't know, I really appreciated that.
Mm-hmm. And he did say, like, he said, you know, it still is mostly the men who initiate. And so I'm going to deal with this reality and talk about what it looks like when a man just sends out a hey text, like, to every single girl on his phone. And he has a very funny screenshot of someone on a dating app where it's just like he sent out 20 hey's in a row and like no one's replied. Because, like, what do you say to hey? You say hey back, and that goes nowhere.
And it was like H-E-Y-Y. Why? That part was awesome. By the way, listeners, if any of you have ever been to Aziz Ansari's show, I really wish after reading this book that I had been to one of these shows where he was, you know, compiling his research. Please go on our Facebook page and tell us about the experience, because I'm incredibly curious about what the experience was like.
My response to that was quite the opposite, because there are parts of the book that I like very much, but I didn't care for the sociology. And although he did get some good examples from his shows and the various kind of research efforts that they made, my response was, if I paid surely a good amount of money to see Aziz Ansari, I want to see his jokes. I want to laugh. I don't particularly care to see someone's iPhone screen. I want to see their chat logs. Like, I can do that on my own time. I don't need to pay money to have, you know, like, someone's Tinder screen projected onto, you know, a massive screen at the Madison Square Garden.
But it's funny. But this is like the real life. It's like observational comedy about real life. And this is the way people are living their real lives now.
Yeah, that's maybe so. But I want more, like, and, you know, there are certain things about this book that he's clearly a very likable guy. I think he'd be an awesome, like, chat show host, although that might be a step down for him at this point. Like, he's clearly very personable. He's good at kind of talking to people. But I want stuff that he's worked on. I don't want just some, like, hey, and now I'm just going to look at some stranger's phone for the first time and just riff on it. I want like, scripted bloody humor.
Isn't that what comedy shows always do? They're like, hey, where are you from? Like, is this your first date? You know?
That wouldn't be the one that I would pay money for.
I have to say, that's what we do, June, by the way.
Yeah, we riff.
Yeah, we do. That's all.
Yeah,
we
but
do.
Nobody's paying $100 an hour, like, for a ticket.
That's true. We riff and it's free. So
get what you pay for.
It's like the Emma Sulkowitz thing. You, like, bring in your audience, you make them complicit, you know, and I'm sure it's improv, which everyone's all into now. And I personally love improv.
Not me.
It sounded like there were genuinely funny moments in that. At one point, he's describing, there was a French woman in the audience, and she's so confused by this. Like, she just doesn't get the comedy of these awkward texts that Americans are sending back and forth. And he asks her, you know, like, what would a man text you after an
say
encounter?
With a French accent. Oh, say
wait,
with a French
but I have
accent.
To find. Okay, here's the exact.
It's like, well, no, you do it.
And she says he would write, "Fancy a fuck?" I don't know what accent that was. That was not French.
Bulgarian, but it's pretty good.
Bulgarians are super sexy.
I actually took French, and the sad part about my French career was that I just never had the accent down. I was very good
at reading. I don't think fuck is really like a good French. You can't fancy a fuck.
I know, but I just had a tin ear. Anyway, so he says, well, what would you write back? And she says, I would write oui or no, depending on whether I fancied one or not, which is a very French response and very efficient. But if someone said that to you and an American you'd met at a bar or who was just like texting you on Tinder or whatever, you would be appalled and hurt, even though it's the subtext of what you are eventually building towards. But we have this thing where like, you know, you have to go on a certain number of dates and he has to send a certain number of messages before I feel comfortable meeting him. So that was a moment that genuinely came up in this show.
I will admit that this is not a solid piece of sociology, even though Eric Kleinenberg is writing it. I, as a person who reads the New York Times and is a journalist, recognized, like I could tell who he was going to quote next. Yeah. Like, oh, cue Esther Perel.
Exactly.
You know?
Like, Andrew Cherlin, back here again.
Cue Andrew Cherlin.
Stephanie Kuntz.
Stephanie Kuntz is coming next. Like you knew.
Dan Savage.
You knew who was coming up, right?
Sure, the same people. Step on down.
Exactly. It's like a reality show. So but that doesn't mean that everybody, I just still found the book a pleasure to read, like as a page to page, you know, there's a standard way in which these now, you know, God knows how big an advance he got.
$3.5 million
comedy memoirs are written, which is just my life, right? Yeah. And some people can pull that off, like Tina Fey, who's just like a really, really good essayist. Most people can't. And I thought this was a nice hodgepodge. So page to page, it was sort of pleasurable. Like I loved, so there's this sort of, not bogus sociology, but sociology I'm quite familiar with about what kind of pictures on dating sites bring the most clicks, right? Profile photos.
Yeah.
And yet I thought his take on this sociology, which is often very boring, was extremely funny. Like the pictures he chose and then the captions he put. I mean, I know this is a audio show, so it's annoying what I'm doing because you can't really see. But there's like a guy in the desert. You know, he looks like he's in Desert Storm or something or in Afghanistan, and he looks all military and there's a desert behind him. And the caption is, I'm staring at my brother whose leg I just ate. I've been lost in the desert for 3 weeks without food or water. Also, I like photography and playing guitar. It's just and how, like, you know, cause, and that's that awesome thing that, you know, for women you're supposed to shoot from the top down and look flirty, like you're supposed to be all, you know, making love with the camera, whereas for men you're supposed to be not smiling and looking into the far off distance.
Right.
So these are things I've already read, but his take on them was, it's just very funny.
Yeah. I loved the book. I found it very charming. And part of it was like, okay, I have read a million of these sociological studies, and they are all, the ones, at least the ones he's citing here, are all kind of about me as a like millennial who is, you know, who's dated. But they all feel like people are observing aliens or bonobos or something. It's just like, it's so academic and removed. And even when you recognize the stats and what they're describing is accurate, it just doesn't sort of grab you. And whereas the examples, it had, you know, in the way that good comedy can take something absurd and like suss out something very true, and that's kind of why you're laughing, it had that feeling to it. Like it just felt, the anecdotes in this just felt super real. And just the way he analyzed text messages was just like the way you do it with your friends at a bar or whatever. Like there's one example, he talks about someone at a show. People always say, if you really like someone, the text doesn't matter. And he's like, no, it matters so much. Like even just, you know, the spelling or whatever. So he talks about this woman, Rachel, who's met someone at a wedding and she was into him, and he texts her. And there's a whole long text, and in it he says, I wanted to say hi and sort of, quote, texty, introduce myself. Ha ha, smiley face. And I'm sorry, he writes, as soon as I said texty, it was clear that no one sitting in the 3,600-seat Chicago theater would ever fuck this dude in a million years. And it's true. There are just things you see when you see the way someone chooses to present themselves. Right. Like, they've had time to think about this, you know? And texty is just like, oh, what a word.
You know what makes me feel? I actually read this, that part outside out loud to my daughter. I did not read the part about no one would fuck him, but just to see her response to the word texty. So not everyone has a facility with words. Like, that guy maybe would have been charmingly awkward in a phone conversation, but just is overly formal and ridiculous in the written word. So I just thought this just must change the game for people who are better with words or worse with words. It must make it better for some people and just much worse for other people.
I'd love to. There are very many things in this book that I was fascinated by. So I know I'm a little like I do. And it might just be like knowing about that $3.5 million, which I understand why he got that. And that just because I'm a little bit jealous does not, you know, shouldn't affect my experience too much. But I did kind of wish that sometimes it was written by somebody like Seth Stevenson or John Swansburg, who, I don't know, I felt could have thought just a tiny bit harder and maybe written with a little more style. Like, he didn't really make me laugh that much, except maybe once. But some of the things were like genuinely new to me. For all of the, oh yeah, this is like, you know, an article in The Atlantic that I read, you know, three times already. There were moments where he did get to something that I found fascinating, like how once you start really trying to set up a date on texts or even any kind of setup date, you're secretarying. I love that concept of secretarying, where just kind of the act of, oh, shall we go here? Shall we go there? Where, you know, the research for the date, the kind of the coordination is such a boner kill on both sides that, like, by the time you actually, you know, the time comes around, you're like, oh, Jesus, I don't know if I want to leave the house. You know?
Yeah. I found his prose charming, in part because you just, like, I don't know. These books can be so boring, and it's not a boring subject. And I also liked that it was written by a dude. I just did. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about how would we have thought about it if, like, Mindy Kaling, for instance, mm-hmm. had written this book? Mm-hmm. I think it would have been there would have been just a slightly different response to it.
Yeah. I mean, I think he's definitely, he's not quite being himself unless he really is not at all shaken by the fact that he's a very, at this point, surely a very rich man, you know, mm-hmm. that he has, you know, that when he's in L.A. and when he invites a woman over to hook up, which doesn't mean what I thought it meant, that he's staying in, who's the name
James
of the actor?
James Earl Jones.
He's staying in James Earl Jones' beach house, which is not where I would be staying. And that he's very famous and that
June, he's just looking for true love. You're
I know. Well, and he was, no, I thought he was really effective at not, you know, that all of those things could make him a total douche, and he didn't seem at all douchey, and it seemed like he was making a really, like, performing a really great service of helping guys especially to text better, just to be better at dating. That seemed like a really great service that he was performing.
I interviewed him once, and the only thing I remember from it was, like, at a party. The only thing I remember from the interaction was that he said, bring your microphone closer. This is not going to record. Like, he was concerned for my interview. So Aziz Ansari, in my book, my one brush with that fame is that he was a nice, thoughtful guy.
People should totally read this book, especially if they're dating. And I would also say that the thing I found completely delightful is he unearthed in the archives an old style of online dating, which is when people used to make these little mini YouTube videos, and they are they're part of the preview for the book, and they are super freaking hilarious. They are really, really funny. All right, well, let's move to our recommendations. But before we do, sponsor number three, NatureBox. We were judging NatureBox by the Lady Report Card. Once again, it gets an A. Why is that? Because I said,
are you grading on a curve?
Damn it. No, because they have all these awesome snacks, praline pumpkin seeds, sweet blueberry almonds, lemon tea biscuits. I'm reading from the website now, Big Island pineapple. They're incredibly delicious. They have no artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners, zero grams of trans fat, no fructose corn syrup, and they taste incredibly good. And there are lots and lots of snack options out there. So instead of hauling your butt out to wherever, the Whole Foods somewhere else, you can just order and grab these sweets, sweet blueberry almonds, salted caramel pretzel pops, many of them that you might love, that your kids might love, that you can take to work, feed everybody with. So right now, if you go to naturebox.com/XX, you can get a free trial of their favorite snacks. That's naturebox.com/XX. And I am not spelling any of that for any of you. I am sorry. Okay. June, what is your recommendation for this week?
So last weekend, my girlfriend was away and I always turn a little bit feral, which means just basically not getting up from the couch for any reason whatsoever. So I spent way too much time watching Sense8, which is a 12-episode series on Netflix. And it's about 8 people in different parts of the world. It's an international cast. It was filmed, you know, in 8 different cities around the world. So like Seoul, Chicago, San Francisco, London, Reykjavik, Mumbai. So it's very beautiful to look at. And it's about 8 people who have a kind of a connection so that they can help each other. It's a very beautiful and slightly confusing. It's a little bit hard to get into, I confess. But in the last 2.25 hours or so, there are some really beautiful, like mind-blowingly, mind-expandingly new connections. It's about the radical power of love and connection and sex. It's quite a bit of sex. And I, in the end, was very just charmed and sort of entertained and found it very beautiful. So I really recommend Sense8 on Netflix.
Sounds amazing. I have 2 recommendations. The first is a documentary called Since We Were Talking About Love and Finding Love. The best version of The Search for Love that I've seen in a very long time is a documentary by Julie Sokolow called Aspie Seeks Love. It's about this guy, David Matthews, who was diagnosed with Asperger's when he was in his 40s. And it's just so incredibly charming. Some of it is just heartbreaking. Like, he spends 20 years posting ad flyers to telephone poles, like making these really funny jokes about himself and why women should date him, and has absolutely no love, no luck, I mean. And then you just kind of, you know, follow him along until his life changes. It's just so, so dear and charming. The second one is the new podcast, which I'm sure you hardcore podcast fans have heard of. It's been top in the charts for the last couple of weeks, called Mystery Show, done by our competitors Gimlet, by Starley Kine. We're going to talk about it a little bit on our next show. We have a special guest coming on, the novelist Sheila Hetty, who I love. And so there's a lot of divided opinions about this show. So if you can, listen to it before in the next couple of weeks, and so you can be avidly a part of the conversation. Noreen.
My recommendation, and I feel a little embarrassed to recommend it because it's a classic, but I'd never seen it until a couple weeks ago. And neither had my 2 friends who I watched it with, who are my age. So I'm going to recommend it for people sort of 30 and under who might have been too young for this the first time around. But I watched Thelma and Louise for the first time, and it's just fantastic.
Isn't it so awesome?
It's just everything about it is fantastic. From, you know, the 2 actresses to their clothing to just the script, the ending. The ending made me sad, but whatever.
Do you think it ever could have ended that way now? Like, would they, that ending kind of captured a certain kind of fatalism? Like, you could try, but you could never win. Like, it's like the Emma Salkowitz point we were making. Like, can you still try and never win? Or do you think they would win now?
Yeah, it's totally radical. I think now they would have, you know, workshopped it with audiences, and people like me would have been like, I don't know, it made me kind of bummed out, and they would have changed it. But it absolutely had to end that way. That's the only way that movie could end. It's amazing. I still haven't seen Mad Max, but I sort of picture Mad Max being the same kind of like scorched earth feminism, just with amazing backdrops.
This makes me want to do a movie club in the summer. I don't know that our listeners would stand for it, but it would be fun for us, like an old timey movie club.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
People can send in suggestions.
That's a good idea. Send in suggestions if you can tolerate this idea of old-timey, feminist-y movies that we can watch and discuss in the summer. Okay, well, thanks to our producer, Anne Hepperman, our managing producer, Joel Meyer, Andy Bowers, the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Our intern is Jesse Chasen-Tabor. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. For more information about this show, go to our show page, slate.com/xx. Leave comments and answer my questions on our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest, or you can send us an email if you want more privacy, XXGabFest@slate.com, and subscribe on iTunes so other people can find out about the show. For Noreen and June, I am Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you again in 2 weeks. All
right. Could you spell that for me?
Spell this, June.
a female. My sexual preference is females. Since you are a girl, this is very convenient. Girl, I wanna take you out tonight to go get a sandwich, 'cause I'm oh so hungry. Do you like sandwiches, girl?
I'm Maureen O'Connor, one of the hosts of New York Magazine Sex Lives podcast. And this week we have an interview with Dr. Ruth, and we discuss why millennials aren't boning as much as our parents did. You can subscribe to Sex Lives on iTunes.com/Panoply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.